There are thousands of supposedly haunted houses all over the world, every bed and breakfast looking for some off-season bookings, and every abandoned building on basic cable has a ghost these days. But a 16th century mansion in Hampshire, England, demands to be taken more seriously. So that's what we're going to do here on this latest episode of the Weird World Podcast, with the story of the haunting of Hinton Ampner.
Hi, welcome to the Weird World Podcast. Happy Halloween World season, Dean.
Hi, Carrie.
That's who I am. Okay. Yeah, I guess we're going to talk about haunted houses.
A haunted house specifically. Well, I'll give you a little bit before that, though, some history. Go ahead.
Okay, what did you say the name of it is?
Hinton Ampner. Very weird name. H-I-N-T-O-N. Separate word. A-M-P-N-E-R.
That's the name of the house?
The name of the house. It's like one of those big old manor houses from the late 1500s, I think it was
built. I mean,
great name.
I'm not on board.
There's some old, you know,
name.
English thing for what it meant. It was like built, the Ampner means it was built on, I can't remember.
You know, oh, okay.
It has swampy ground. Yeah, kind of, okay. Sort of. A corruption of blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
First, I want to start about talking about haunted houses in a more fun way. I, as you know, I'm kind of a fan of haunted houses,
yeah.
Even though I want to go to one this year. But a few years ago, some people got a little bigger shock than they bargained for in Green Bay, Wisconsin, when a Halloween themed haunted house that's popular with the local folks had a little surprise in store for some of their people. Every year they redid it. They had actors come in and fog and lights and all that kind of stuff. In 2016, folks who put on this haunted house decided to look into a couple of caskets that they were using for the first time that year as part of the decor. So mm-hmm. these coffins had been up in storage, I guess, for a long time in this house. And they said, hey, let's bring those down here and put them in the, you know, one of the rooms that was used to scare the folks traipsing through the house on during Halloween month. So obviously they're fake. It's just nice hijinks. It'll be fun. They had a catacombs. They had a bunch of skeletons hanging in this room, and they had these caskets. So, quote, "This right here is where you enter into the hallway and catacombs room," said a woman named Miranda Shutt. She was the social media coordinator for this haunted house. So it's been a big deal.
Yeah.
"And then we have the full skeleton here. Upon closer look, realized those are not fake bones." They were not fake bones. They had to retrieve the skeletons, from those two caskets in storage, and they had hung them up in the catacombs room, thinking that those were fake skeletons.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who noticed, but someone took a closer look and said, "Hey, guess what? Those bones are real. Those are actual human skeletons you have hanging in this haunted house in Green Bay, Wisconsin."
Oh.
Quote, "We don't really know the era of the casket. We're guessing it's maybe from the 1900s. They thought, okay, they must be just from like a medical school or something like that, but they don't know. And tell me if you think this is true. Haunted houses seem to have kind of, I guess, a skeleton buried is kind of a trope, isn't it? For haunted houses, for some kind of a haunting, like improperly buried, or the murder victim, you know, buried on the premises, something like that. And that's why the house is being haunted has become kind of a trope in horror movies and horror TV shows these days modern times, don't you think? I can't think of that many, except every third episode of Supernatural, where that's happened. But it's, you know, I guess not. Poltergeist. Poltergeist, of course, was on a graveyard, but kind of the same idea.
The old Indian burial ground.
Yeah,
trope.
Exactly. But even more, it's like, you know, the improperly buried or the victim, the murder victim.
Right.
And once you have the bones and do the right thing with them, the house is no longer haunted. That's a little bit. It was said that the Fox sisters, the people who invented spiritualism, that house, supposedly, decades later after they had left it, was investigated, and they found bones in some, you know, buried in some,
of course,
in the basement or something like that.
Yeah.
Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes stories, he claimed that he had investigated personally a poltergeist situation, a poltergeist case, where he had found bones buried on the house that was experiencing this poltergeist activity. Again, according to Arthur Conan Doyle, he, as you know, became a very, very strong believer in spiritualism and the supernatural. And there's been lots of in fiction too. The Castle of Otranto, The Canterville Ghost by Oscar Wilde, the classic, The Haunting of Hill House, and of course, The Turn of the Screw, one of the best horror stories ever, Hell House, a novel, and even The Shining by Stephen King. I don't remember that, to be honest with you, but I just found a list of books that had treated this idea of skeletons being buried on these supposedly haunted places. I honestly can't remember it in The Shining, so that may be an AI hallucination, I'm not sure. So, but it goes back an incredibly long time. I'm going to tell you a story that was written by Gaius Plinius Secundus, better known, as you know, as Pliny the Younger, the famous lawyer, Roman lawyer and lawmaker of the first century CE.
Sure.
You never heard of Pliny the Younger?
Yeah.
And don't cheat into the beer by Russian River Brewing Company, which is delicious.
Only because of the beer.
Okay. And Pliny the Elder as well, too, was his father. Pliny the Younger, though, lived in the first century, as I said. And he, in his records, was found a letter to his friend, Lucius Licinius Sura, who was a senator from Hispania, modern-day Spain. And he was asking for some advice from Lucius in this letter, because he had recently heard a ghost story that intrigued him. Quote, "I'm extremely desirous," wrote Pliny the Younger, "to know whether you believe in the existence of ghosts and that they have a real form and are a sort of divinities or only the visionary impressions of a terrified imagination." Seems kind of modern, doesn't it? Apparently, Pliny knew about a family that had recently a strange ghostly experience. One of the young family members and a slave had their hair cut while they were asleep.
Ooh.
They thought by a ghost. A hair-cutting ghost. Interesting. Reminds me of the demon barber of Pascagoula, which was a real person, but this or maybe that was a ghost.
Yeah.
Back in episode, I don't know. That was kind of weird, but he had been told an even weirder story involving a Stoic philosopher named Athenodorus Canonites. He was a Greek philosopher.
Okay.
He had been a friend of Cicero and a tutor to Octavian, who became the future Caesar Augustus. So here's how this story went. So Athenodorus was Greek, but of course he was, Greece was part of the Roman Empire. And so he had been a pretty important guy in Rome at that time. So it was said that Athenodorus, let's go with that.
Sure.
Had heard about an abandoned house in Athens that just could not find a buyer. No one would buy this house. It seemed that recent residents had reported these strange loud noises and they'd bang and slam throughout the entire night. They would also hear chains rattling. Sometimes sounds like metal smashing against metal. Sometimes they even saw the ghost of an old man. He would appear and he was said to look like emaciated, starved, disheveled. And he would have chains across his arms and he'd rattle his chains at the people living in the house at the time. So the inhabitants of this house were just absolutely terrified, and they couldn't sleep. They couldn't live in anymore. Their health started to fail, and eventually those inhabitants died. So it's pretty serious. A ghost, in a sense, killed people, maybe, sort of. After the owner of the home could not find a buyer, though, the house was left abandoned for some time. So those folks had been renting it. But everything has its price, even back then. And so the owner, the landlord, started dropping the rent. He was asking for that house until it was just dirt cheap. It was well located right there in a beautiful, cozy home in central Athens. Walkability score was like 94, okay? So luckily, this was the time when Athenodorus came to Athens. He was going to, research stuff. Remember, he's a philosopher. Uh-huh. And he needed a place to stay while he was there. He's going to live there for some time. He was on a philosopher's salary, though, so he was not picky of what abode he would have, I guess, apparently. So he found out about this place with this really cheap rent, with its great location. Again, walkable to the library, but he's going to spend a lot of time, one presumes. He was suspicious, though, as you should be, that he thought that rent was so odd that something was wrong. This is a big house. It had grounds around it, like a yard. It didn't make any sense. Again, heart of Athens. As Pliny wrote, quote, "The extraordinary cheapness raised his suspicion," end quote. A lot of this stuff sounds really modern to me, by the way. When Athenodorus inquired about, okay, what's going on with this cheap rent, he was actually surprisingly maybe told the actual story. The landlord told him about this noisy ghost. And, you know, here the rattling chains, the person, the emaciated looking man with the chains over his arms, the whole thing. Instead of being deterred by this, Athenodorus was hooked. He took the house at once. He was, you know, he was going to study this thing. He was going to be a ghost hunter, a first century Greek ghost hunter.
Wow.
I like that too. So he had a couch brought out into the main room at the front of the house. And on that very first night in residence there, he prepared to experience the supernatural in person. And like any modern basic cable ghost hunter, he was ready to find ghosts with the best technology he had at the time.
Well, did he have a family or was it just him?
It was just him.
Oh, okay.
He had a servant. So I don't know. I think he made them leave the house because he wanted to be undisturbed. So he had like, hey, bring me a sofa, you know, a candle, that kind of thing. And of course, these days, the technology would be like what? Like motion activated cameras and EMF meters, because those are things. And of course, one of the key technologies that modern ghost hunters have to have is the ability to pretend that you felt something run its finger along the back of your neck, and when actually nothing whatsoever had happened to you.
In cold spots, too.
Cold spots, too. Yeah. Oh, my God. Is it cold here? Yeah. Uh-huh. It's very cold. Look, the thermometer has a reading. 79.2 over here. It's 80.1. It's a ghost. So what he had, though, was pencils and a tablet. I don't know what the tablet would have been. What would he have written on? Did they have paper?
Oh, they must have.
They must have. I know the Egyptians had papyrus, yeah, which you pronounce papyrus. but I've corrected you many times. Uh-huh. You still pronounce it the wrong way. I'm pretty sure that's how I remember it. And but anyway, he has a writing utensil, so put it that way. He's going to record what happened. He's just going to experience it. He's going to write it down. He's a first century ghost hunter using first century technology. His brain.
Yeah.
As always in these situations, though, you have to build the tension, don't you? And counterintuitively, I think the best way, you've seen this in a million haunted house types or, you know, haunting type stories. So the best way to build tension is for nothing to happen for a long time.
Yeah.
You might have something that seems like it's happened, but it's nothing. You almost, that's also kind of a trope. Well, this is what happened. He's up for hours. It's getting late. The candle is burning lower and nothing's going on. He's not hearing any sounds. He's not seeing any ghosts whatsoever. So I guess then finally, you know, your adrenaline's up, but it starts to simmer after a couple hours, you know. That's when you have the first jump scare. Same thing for Athenodorus. It was in the small hours of the morning when all of a sudden, boom, he hears this loud clanging, this kind of metal clanging type sound. Then he hears these iron chains rattling and rolling and clanging against one another somewhere in this dark house, maybe even outside the house. He's not sure.
Wait, I have what I think is a stupid question.
What is it?
What are these houses built out of? Are they wooden or?
I don't think they would have been wooden.
I wouldn't think so either.
Stone, brick?
Oh.
Adobe? I'm making that up. No. I'm not a billion percent sure. I don't know about, not like, you know, beautiful marble and things like that.
Yeah.
Temples were built for him. But just stone?
Quarry, right. You know? Stone, but there would have to be wood flooring and stuff, right?
Oh, sure.
Especially
sure,
if it's a
sure,
two-story.
I don't think it was two stories.
Oh, okay.
No, it was not two stories.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it had a lot of, they did. But
you said it was big.
Big. I didn't say it's two stories. I didn't give you square footage, Carrie. It's 2,183 square feet net. So, I don't know. It was a nice, beautiful house. Again, what I really harped on was this beautiful central location and this walkability.
That's true.
It was famous for that. But so these sounds are heard, but nothing seen by Athenodorus. Unlike every TV ghost hunter who wildly exaggerates every noise, you know, every supposed cold spot, Athenodorus kept calm and carried on. He told himself, you know what? I don't know what they are, but they're not ghosts. If I thought about it long enough, I can explain this. I don't think they're anything. Maybe I'm even just imagining it because I've kind of been primed to hear a ghost. He was very rational. He was a stoic, as we know. He assiduously kept his head down, scratching out his thoughts on the tablet on his lap. So he's not even, you know, peering around all the time. I'm sure he did, but he's just trying to focus and not get himself too worked up by just writing down everything he's thinking and everything he hears.
Did he go looking for the source of
anything? It doesn't seem like he did. He's kicking back on the couch.
Okay.
And he's just trying to soak it up.
I think he's scared. That's why.
He might be a little scared. Yeah. The sounds, though, were having none of his inattention to them. So the dragging and the clanking and the rattling drew closer and closer to him as he hunkered down in that sofa until finally Athenodorus heard them right outside the door. Now, I think they're on the outside. The story's not completely clear, but I think they're on the outside, like in the yard in front of the house. That's the sense I get, though. And then weirdly, it's almost, he seemed like maybe they were even inside the room with him. They're that loud. They seemed that close, but he still hasn't seen anything yet.
Yeah.
Finally, though, he looks up from his, you know, scratching away on his tablet. And then he finally does see a ghost. This apparition is just suddenly, it seemed like it's suddenly there. And it looked just like the person he'd been warned about. You know, this old man, he's emaciated, he's kind of ethereal looking, and he's looming over him as Athenodorus sits on the couch, now probably, you know, white knuckling his tablet and pencil. He probably snapped his pencil. They said pencil, by the way. Did they have pencils back then?
I don't know.
I don't know that either. I think of a quill and ink for some reason, but I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't call that a pencil.
They used the word pencil.
Like a piece of graphite or something.
I wonder if they're making indentations into something like clay or something like that. It just doesn't seem like you'd be able to take quick notes with that kind of thing. I don't know. Probably should have looked that up, but I have no idea what the media he was writing on, but he was writing, apparently. And so this person, this ghost, is standing over him, and he reaches out his hand, his bony fingers, and he curls that index finger and waggles it toward him as if to say, come with me.
Waggles.
Uh-huh. You don't like the word? You don't like that? I thought it was a good word.
What is that called?
What's the what called?
When you do this.
I believe it's called waggling. Carrie's making the think listeners, of that classic, like, come here.
Curling your finger. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to call it waggling now. I believe that's going to catch on.
Huh.
So he's basically saying, hey, Athenodorus, come with me. Get up. Let's go. But Athenodorus knew that this ghost was not the boss of him. He was, remember, kind of a big deal in the philosophy world. So he puts up his hand, like his outstretched palm, toward the ghost, as if to say, hold on, I'm not done yet. Give me a minute. And he keeps writing, puts his head back in towards his tablet and keeps writing his impressions as the ghost, I'm sure, stewed in paranormal anger at this affront. Pretty ballsy move, pretty boss move, if you ask me, by Athenodorus. The ghost was not pleased, though. He pulled his chains up and put them like over Athenodorus's head and rattled them in a kind of pretty threatening way.
Such a stereotype of a ghost.
It's like, well, he's pissed.
Rattling chains.
Okay.
Is this where it came from?
Pardon?
Is this where that whole thing came from?
It's an early story. It might be, actually. Athenodorus, master of the boss move or not, at this point goes, okay, I better go. This is getting pretty scary. He knew when enough was enough. So he looked up and he sees the ghost again beckoning him with the waggle of the finger. And so this time Athenodorus says, okay, you got me. He rose up and he started following the specter. It gets confusing here. The ancient accounting seems pretty muddled because it seems like he's inside the house, sometimes he's outside the house. At this point, I believe he's following the ghost outside the house, and you know why that almost has to be true in a second. So Athenodorus is following the ghost outside the house into the yard, like the front yard, and he's walking through over the grass, the field in front of the house, and Athenodorus is like right on his heels. He's brought his candle, his little lamp or candle with him, and he's following close by as the guy wags, rattles his chains and walks across the yard. And then just like that, the ghost like took a turn as if to turn back toward the house and vanished, disappeared right in front of his eyes. Athenodorus is, I'm sure, freaked out. But remember, he was essentially a scientist of his day.
Uh-huh.
So he thought, okay, I think I need to mark this spot. It's important, the exact place where he vanished. He seemed to be, was that a goal? Was that a destination?
Yeah.
So he got a bunch of leaves and some sticks and stuff like that. And he just piled a little pile of detritus on top of the exact spot where this ghost had disappeared. The very next morning, Athenodorus goes to the local magistrate and says, hey, it just happened to me. I think you guys know the story about this house, this haunted house. I think I can figure things out. What's happening here? Come with me. You guys need to dig up a spot in the yard where that ghost disappeared. Now, again, this is where Athenodorus must have been a somebody, because they did.
Yeah.
So they sent people out, the city officials, whatever, sent folks out with Athenodorus. They went back and they dug up the yard. And what do you think they found?
A skeleton.
Their shovels hit a bone and then another bone.
Told
you. They dug further and they quickly uncovered the entire skeleton of a man and his rusty, moldering chains wrapped around his arms. So he'd been dead for a little while. And if we know horror tropes, we know what happens next. So what happens next?
The haunting is done.
Now you got to do something first.
Because you got to burn the bones?
No, that's more if it's like a demon, I believe.
You got to correctly bury them.
You got to correctly bury them, exactly. Yeah. So the bones are collected from this hasty burial that almost certainly was done by this guy's murderer. You know, with the emaciation, was he starved to death or something like that? I don't know. But anyway, they gathered the skeleton together and they gave him a proper burial, let's say in the city cemetery. I don't know. And from that day forward, the ghost was never seen in the house again, and no sound of chains or rattling anything sounded through the hallways ever again.
Did they do any investigation to see who used to live in the house?
If they did, Pliny didn't write about it.
Oh.
It happened years before Pliny wrote about it.
Sure.
So, and he was hearing it, obviously, secondhand, or more likely, fifth hand, tenth hand. So you go back, and this trope about skeletons being, this whole skeletons being needing to be disinterred and buried properly, whatever,
yeah,
to end a haunting goes back at least to that story from over 2,000 years ago now. Uh-huh. And there was a reason, though, why the Greek and Romans believed skeletons played a role in the supernatural visitations. The Greeks' concept of ghosts was a little bit more tenuous than the Romans. They weren't really that into ghosts. It wasn't a big deal. They did have the kind of heaven and hell, right? They believed this place called Elysium, where the good souls went to, and Tartarus was the destination for the not so good, kind of like heaven and hell. Not perfect analog, but more or less.
Yeah.
And they even had something kind of like a limbo, where the dead who'd been forgotten or improperly sent to the afterlife would roam Hades in a kind of purgatory. And I don't think Hades is really a fair analog for hell. And movies and TV have made it so, but it really wasn't thought of as what Christians would think of as hell.
I kind of think of it more as purgatory.
Something like that. Yeah. So that they'd go to Hades to roam around if their deaths weren't done right.
Right.
And your outcome, by the way, of where you went was mostly based to the Greeks on leading a decent life, but also on following proper rituals and also not pissing off the always irritable gods. Remember how many Greek god stories are like, oh, I pissed them off, so I turned them into a swan after I raped them, kind of a thing. So you really didn't want to upset the gods and live a good life, and you'd go to the right place. Remembering your ancestors and honoring them was one of the key ways to do that, and to keep their souls in the good graces of the gods. And so it was considered a critical duty, not just for people, of every person, but also like the cities too. Remember their dead.
Huh.
Failure to do this was the surest way to get haunted or to have a haunting. Ghosts were the souls of the dead that were not properly honored.
How far back do we have to go?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think, people are forgotten, and that's when they are they can become ghosts, when you're forgotten or wind up in Hades. So which makes the argument that theoretically, could you go from Elysium to Hades once you're forgotten? I don't know.
Because, I mean, eventually, everybody who knew you is going to be dead.
Well, but your story lives on, you know.
Hopefully, somebody told your story.
Sure. And somebody tells it, and then they tell it. And then they tell it. Exactly. No, that's I don't know. I don't know how far back you have to go. And I don't know if there is this, afterlife switcheroos or not. I'm not a Greek religious scholar quite. So
I hope none of your ancestors are relying on you.
No, I'm not very good at that.
They're going to be in trouble.
You're the one on Ancestry.com. Maybe that's why Ancestry.com is so popular.
But I don't know stories about them.
Well, you know their names now. I think that's good enough. Maybe we don't have to have the rituals maybe so much. I'm not sure how that works.
So let's hope Jerutha Damewood has gotten her right place.
That's a name from my family?
Jerutha.
That is a fun. I thought I didn't have any phenomenal names. We've talked about so many phenomenal names in this podcast. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I'll have to tell her a story somehow. We'll make it weird. Sometimes also, by the way, you could bring up a soul from Hades, and our soul could come from Hades occasionally and pester the living. Our necromancers could call up, almost like force a soul to come up, and souls didn't like this. Like, leave me alone. What do you want me for? And they say, hey, go haunt my enemy. Okay, but then I'm going right back, and you piss me off. So ghosts were more worried about, I guess, in ancient Rome than they were in ancient Greece. They had the same kind of this tripartite resting places. They had a place called the Field of Elysium, but that was for like heroes and really prominent folks. Mm-hmm. They had the pleasant but less than heroic plains as of Asphodel, and that was where just like good and decent folk went to. Bad people were sent again to Tartarus because they borrowed so much from Greece, where the souls would be tortured. Though this does seem more like hell, doesn't it? They'd be tortured until they had paid enough of a price to cancel the harm they had done while they were alive. So you were, I don't know, if they had like a scale, like a bank robber. Okay. Did they have banks? Whatever. You know, you were tortured for 7 years. And I don't know. I'm making that up, but I bet they did.
Yeah.
So again, rituals and proper worship were a huge part of how your soul was weighed. So if when you died, if your family didn't do it right, you could wind up in the bad place through no fault of your own, essentially. And naturally, part of doing right by the dead was burying them in the proper way. That was very important. So those who were not properly buried were sometimes denied entrance into the right parts of the afterlife, or into the afterlife, and they'd be more of that wandering ghost kind of a thing. So that's kind of where that comes from. Remember,
so what happens to people nowadays who are not buried anywhere?
Well, we're not in ancient Greece or Rome. So,
so it's okay.
It's fine. Yeah, because we don't believe that. It's only true if you believe it. wait, that's not true.
But are there current religions that care
Well, I know
about
a lot
that?
Of a lot of Asian beliefs center. We've talked about that on ancestors memory and rituals.
But what about
and
the
honor
whole burial
like
thing?
I don't know.
I think they need to update their
rituals
and policies.
I believe they should.
To allow for cremations.
Very few people believe in the religions, the pantheocratic, is that the right word? Pantheistic religions of ancient Greece and Rome. It's more of a Christian thing now in Greece.
Although I think there are some religions where you're not supposed to be buried, where you're not allowed to be cremated.
Yeah, no, for sure. Mm-hmm. Remember, Pliny was a Roman. He was not Greek. So when he was writing about this Greek ghost, it was a little more, you know, scary to him. And it made sense to him hearing this story about Athenodorus that, skeleton found and properly buried would extinguish this ghost. Yeah. It made a lot of sense in his Roman belief system. And modern society, of course, has carried this ancient notion to the modern day. So I am going to tell you a story that does have something along those lines. It's a pretty interesting haunted house story that I'm not going to lie. Has something to be said for it. It's not the level of nonsense that a lot of these stories, or the level just like that didn't happen kind of a thing, because this is pretty well attested to. And the things that occurred, it's very difficult to come up with here's the obvious answer to that.
Yeah.
So this is a story of Hinton Ampner that I spelled earlier and will not spell again. I'll probably mispronounce it several times. It was this large manor house. It was built, I think, the late 1500s, so late 16th century in Hampshire County. That's in England. It's, I think, the very pretty far south of England. It's about 8 miles east of Winchester. I know that doesn't mean anything to you, but it's about 60 plus miles southwest of London. It's immediately north, not immediately, like 20 miles or so north of Portsmouth, a key port on the very southern coast of England. Does that help at all?
No.
Okay. I didn't think it would. Southern England. How's that?
That's fine. You could literally just say England.
I could. It's in Europe. It's in the Eastern Hemisphere, Carrie. In 1719, the heir to the manor was Mary Stukeley. She married Edward Stawell, because everyone has to have an uncomfortable sounding name or just a difficult to pronounce name. Stukeley is spelled Stewkeley. Because
what?
That's how it's spelled. Edward was about 10 years younger than married when they got married.
Oh.
Uh-huh. A little bit of a cradle robber. He was, in turn, the heir to the Lord Stawell. His brother was the current Lord Stawell, who had lands in his own manor house, but he was childless. So younger brother Edward was going to become the future Lord Stawell upon the death of his brother.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay. And despite being older than her husband, presumably, I don't know exactly how old Mary Stukeley was, but she had to be in her 30s. She bore two children with Edward.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, back, right? You didn't have babies late in life, relatively.
I mean, you could.
I know you did.
But plenty of women had babies from their teenagehood all the way up to to 40.
But we know now it's incredibly dangerous and unhealthy. Oh, wait, that's right. We found out that's not true. Okay. Well, she did. She had two kids.
It is sometimes dangerous to keep having them.
But it's been exaggerated.
After I mean the number of babies a lot of people had.
Okay. Oh, yeah, no. These people having 10, 15 babies, just knock it the fuck off.
Yeah. It's my mom. Cool. My mom was told after three, you got to knock that off.
Well, good. Good for her doctor.
Yeah, you need to take a break.
Take a break.
They didn't say knock it off
completely. She took a break forever.
She did.
Good for her. When Mary formally inherited Hinton and Appner upon the death of her father, she also took over the guardianship of her sister, Honoria, who was much younger than her. So I imagine, I think, all in her teens at the time that Mary took over and was the head of household at Hinton Appner.
Okay. So, see, that mother.
Yeah, you're right. Must have had Honoria fairly late.
Unless she was a half-sister from the father.
Right. Don't know.
That happened, too.
Yeah. Mary held on until 1740, when her death left Edward, her husband, with their daughter, because their son had died earlier at boarding school. And he was left also with the upkeep of Honoria, who apparently had not married or left Hinton Appner in all those 21 years. Intriguing.
That's why, because her mother had her late in life.
No, it might be a different reason here. Why hadn't Honoria moved on? You might wonder. Well, it seems there may have been a little something going on between her and brother-in-law, Edward.
Oh, okay.
Possibly all this time. Who knows? We're not sure if anything had happened during Mary's lifetime. But now that Mary was dead, the servants started noticing that Honoria and Edward were acting very friendly with one another. This was just a huge scandal for the time. And it was only locally known, but if it had become generally known, it could have been ruinous for them. Because that kind of relationship was essentially, it was thought of as almost like incest at the time. It's like, you know, that's your sister. It's your sister-in-law, but it was thought of along that way. So the tongues wagged even more when in 1742, Edward's brother died and he inherited his own family estates, as you know, as Lord Stawell.
Right.
Instead of moving to his nice house that he'd grown up in and taking control of the lands he directly held, he stayed at Hinton Appner with Honoria. I don't know, but I imagine it would have been very scandalous if he had gone to his house and brought Honoria with him. That didn't make any sense. Why? She's got a big house now.
Right.
She would have Hinton. He owned Hinton Appner through his wife, but still.
Yeah.
She could have stayed on a Hinton Appner, no problem, and lived in luxury.
Yeah.
So he just decided to stay at Hinton Appner himself so he continued to live with Honoria. So it's fairly certain that he and Honoria were.
Yeah. But he also had a child, right?
He did. But, you know, the child's not that young anymore.
Oh, well, because I was going to say, they kind of became a family, and so, like, that child would be...
Now, that child went off and got married.
Oh.
Yeah. That child's grown up now.
Oh, okay.
She lived 21...
Never you mind.
Yeah, the child's got to be at least almost 20 when this happened, in 1742, and soon thereafter, got married.
Okay.
So, word spread, and not long after...
Well, that is weird that he stays.
It was pretty obvious. I think most people just... The locals knew exactly what was going on, so the rumors started, you know, spreading. And stories from servants at Hinton Appner had it that Honoria was pregnant.
Oh, no.
Edward was kind of the obvious father. Time passed, though, and still no child appeared. Interesting. Had Honoria given birth to a child of this unthinkable scandal? Had that child that could have ruined them both been quietly dispatched once it was free of the womb or somehow died in childbirth and he had hushed it up, had it been buried in some secret hiding place somewhere in the manor or on the grounds around the manor? Local rumor did indeed have it that she had had a child and it had been, quote, done away with.
Yeah. Oh, not died, not.
That's what the rumor was. The rumor was, well, was bad.
That, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more juicy that way.
Yeah. The two survived the scandal, though, and they lived together for many presumably happy years. Honoria died in 1754 of unstated causes. It's not sure what she died. Some people said apoplexy, which I think is like a stroke, right?
don't know.
I think, I'm not sure what it is. Edward did die from a stroke the next year on April 2nd, 1755. He was 56
wow.
when he died. So presumably Honoria was somewhere close to that, but a little bit younger.
Yeah.
It was not long before Edward's ghost was seen by the manor staff roaming the halls and, I don't know, walking through walls or whatever. And they knew it was him by his boring gray clothes, especially his big, quote, drab coat that he was known to wear. Edward and Mary's daughter, meanwhile, had married a guy named Henry Bilson Legge, L-E-G-G-E. Due to a marriage settlement, I think she got a dowry. Henry Legge was going to inherit Hinton Ampner when Edward died. Interesting. So now the Henry Bilson Legge and Mary owned Hinton Ampner.
Uh-huh.
But the Leggs had their own. So Edward died, is now owned by Legge, right? And the
daughter. Wait, shouldn't she also inherit the Stallwell Manor?
No, she has nothing to do with that. Wait. No, because they had.
This is his daughter.
Oh, yeah, it is. I don't know. Yeah, you would think so, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's not commented upon. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Legge, though.
Was he titled? Maybe it had to go to a male heir.
To a male heir and a different, like a nephew or something cousin, like that. Yeah. Probably. So yeah. No one says anything about her having that, so I don't think so.
Okay.
But Legge had his own manor house, so Hinton Ampner was really kind of no use to him. So they wound up using it just like a short-term hunting lodge for a few weeks in the fall during hunting season. Otherwise, it was empty, and it was just like three caretaker staff would be there at all outside of that short time during the hunting season. So Legge finally dies in 1764, and the manor goes back to Edward and Mary's daughter, his wife, right? Now she owns Hinton Ampner again. She, though, almost immediately got remarried to an earl, no less, the Earl of Hillsborough. The earl, again, of course, had his earldom. He had a probably even bigger, nicer house, I'm sure, of his own. So apparently he wasn't a fan of hunting because now he didn't even use it as a hunting lodge. So it was completely more or less abandoned at this point when the Hillsboroughs took over. And they figured, why waste a good mansion? Let's rent it out.
Yeah.
Make a little income from it. So they did. In the meantime, while they're going to rent out the house and getting it nice and spruced up, Edward was still haunting the place. So there was a groom at the time. He was part of the staff there. Again, I don't know if they're staffing up again for the tenants or what have you, but there was a groom who had known Edward while he was alive. He was, I guess, a longtime servant, maybe one of those three caretakers, I imagine.
Yeah.
He had seen this figure on a little hill in the moonlight on some night outside, and he sort of bathed, standing in the moonlight, facing away from him. But he had this big, that drab coat, and he held his hands behind his back, clasped exactly the way he remembered Edward would always stand and hold his hands. And he recognized this figure as his dead employer.
Uh-huh.
So he flees in terror. Again, rumors are rife in the countryside that Hinton Ampner is haunted. And there were sounds too. There were footsteps, there were bangs, there were loud noises. It had the full repertoire of your classic haunting things, both visual and auditory. The staff is increasingly frightened. No one can explain it. They don't understand what's going on. The servants spread word. Word gets farther until the house has a, quote, evil reputation. You would think that'd be a problem for the Hillsboroughs to rent it.
Yeah.
But lucky for them, Henry and Mary Ricketts, her maiden name was Jervis, by the way, which will make a little more important later on. They were not from there. They were from London. So they hadn't heard any of these rumors. And they saw this nice big manor house for rent. I don't know. They were going to live there, by the way. So I don't know why they were moving out of London, because they lived there. It wasn't like a country part-time house. It was their primary abode. So they moved to Hampton. Again, it's about 60 miles away or so from London.
Maybe they wanted some fresh air.
Maybe. Probably so. They wanted to go to live in country life.
Yeah.
So they hadn't heard the rumors. So in January of 1765, when the Ricketts moved into Hinton Ampner, they brought their three young children with them and were ready to have a beautiful life in the country of Southern England. So they started their tenure there in complete ignorance, but very quickly the home's history, they found out about it and they heard about it and they started hearing whispers about its reputation.
Yeah.
So it was not long before the Ricketts began to see, well, not quite firsthand, but their servants began to experience directly what had been said to be going on for years at Hinton Ampner. Mary Ricketts is, she seems like the perfect person to be haunted and convey it, because again, they were from London. So she'd been very well educated. But she was rational. She was very hard headed. She stayed calm. She didn't jump to conclusions. She didn't immediately believe the story she started to hear from the servants. And she was able to not only methodically assess things as they happened in that cursed home, but she started a journal and started writing in detail. Even at the beginning, when she didn't believe what was going on, because mostly it was servant stories.
Yeah.
She wrote about that and wrote about, you know, ridiculing them for these nonsensical superstitions. So she left this record, this very detailed record of what happened there for 6 years while they were tenants there. Oh. And it was published finally in 1872, over 100 years later after these events happened in England by the family. They had kept it close held secret until then. The first signs were sounds. That was kind of, they didn't see any ghosts right away, but there were lots of these sounds. They were very varied. They're often really loud and always inexplicable and unexplainable. So it's like doors slamming. All hours of night, some door would start slamming. And you know, they'd check the house and no one was there and no one would own up to it. It got so bad that Mary thought that, okay, someone's playing tricks. And John did too. Or not John, Henry. Thought also, something's going on here.
Yeah.
I think someone's playing tricks on us. Like, okay, we're the uppity Londoners. These locals don't like us, something like that. You think this is the servants, but it turns out they had brought all of their servants from London.
Oh.
So Henry thought, okay, maybe that's it. They're pissy at us because we didn't hire local.
Yeah.
So, hey, this home's been here for a very long time. Maybe some locals have keys. They are using those keys. They're sneaking in. They're making these goddamn noises. They're hiding out until, you know, we can't find them. There's only a couple of us anyway. And then they're, you know, they leave snickering into their hand and they're having fun with these new Londoners here. So what do you do? He changed every single lock in the entire house.
Oh, wow.
Inside and out. Those sounds did not stop. The summer of that first year, this is 1765, the Ricketts got their first glimpse of Lord Stawell in his gray coat. The nurse of the family's youngest child was minding her kid when she saw a man in a, quote, drab, unquote, coat walk by the open nursery door where she was taking care of the child. And this person walked into the bedroom right across from her, which is called the yellow room because it's painted yellow, directly across the hall from the nursery where she had the kid. This nurse naturally thought, okay, there's a guest here, I guess. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear anybody arrive. But
I didn't invite him. This is the nurse.
This is the nurse. Okay. So she knows it's not a fellow servant. She knows it's not the Henry Ricketts.
Right.
So she figures there's some guest there. And she's a little bit baffled because she didn't know that they were having a guest over that night. Then she didn't know there was any guest in the house at all. So she
he looks like a natural person.
He absolutely does. Yeah. In this case,
translucent.
Yeah.
Just
some guy in a big gray, ugly, boring gray coat walked across the hall, walked into the yellow room, and presumably closed the door behind him. Uh-huh. So she goes down to the servants and says, "So who's the guest here upstairs in the yellow room?" He just went to the yellow room, and the servants go, "What are you talking about?
Yeah,
there are no guests here." So they immediately, this is just the servants now. They immediately organize the search, and they go search every room in the house, and they turn up no one in a gray coat in the entire house. When Mary Ricketts was told about this event, she wrote about it again in detail in her journal, and she said that the nurse was absolutely adamant, quote, "She was much concerned and disturbed, and she was thoroughly assured that she could no ways be deceived, the light being sufficient to distinguish any object clearly." So she was telling her mistress, "Now, I saw what I saw, and it was plenty of light. I didn't make a mistake." Still, Mary is completely unimpressed. She wrote that, quote, "She treated it as the effect of fear or superstition to which the lower class of people are so prone," unquote.
Oh, okay.
So she wrote this. She doesn't come off, I mean, actually she comes off as super rational, super calm, super level-headed, but she has her class prejudices.
Yeah.
So she admits at first she thought they're just dumb servants and they were seeing things, hearing things.
Yeah.
George Turner was the gardener's adult son. He was acting at the groom at the time, this first summer at the manor. He was downstairs and he crossed the grand entry hall, you know, the big grand entry thingy, right? He crosses it on his way up to the wing of the house where the servants' quarters were, where the servants slept one evening. And he, as he's doing this, he catches sight of a man crossing in front of him. It was, again, someone dressed in this quote-unquote drab clothing, this gray kind of boring or beige, I don't know what it was exactly, in this clothing. He thought it must be the butler. The butler had only recently arrived from London and his livery had not been sent yet or prepared yet. So he was just like wearing, I don't know, hand-me-downs or something like that.
Yeah.
So he thought, okay, that's the butler. He's been wearing these kind of blah clothes until his clothes arrive from London. So, okay, no big deal. He finishes whatever he was doing and he goes right up to the bedchamber where the male servants slept, including the butler, when he gets to the, including himself, the groom. When he got up to that bedchamber, who, what does he see?
No butler.
He sees the butler.
Oh, and it's not in the bed, guy he saw.
Sound asleep.
Oh.
He asked the other servant, he says, what's going on? He goes, what are you talking about? He actually went to bed early. He's been asleep here all evening long.
Yeah.
He has not been downstairs. Oh. As Mary wrote, she said, this caused the groom, quote, great astonishment. Yeah, no shit. Yeah. So he's scared shitless.
Well, I was going to say, it's not that scary, though.
You know,
just somebody walking around.
Really, if you saw someone walking around and you know it's no one in that house. Remember, it's already been a few months of weird noises and things like that. You'd be scared. Are you kidding me? You saw a person in the house that should not be there and is not the person you thought it wanted. There's no explanation for that person being in that house.
Yeah, but once I determined it's not an actual person, you know what I mean?
What do you mean?
It's not an intruder.
Oh, I see.
Coming to murder us in our sleep. Then
you don't think so? You think it's probably a ghost then? The ghosts wouldn't scare you? Yes, it would. Okay, this is Carrie who claims that when she was 3 years old, going on the Haunted Mansion ride in Disneyland did not scare her in any way, shape, or form. Little skeptical listeners.
Of course, I would be scared at first, but once you realize he's not doing any harm, he's just walking around.
How do you know he's not going to do harm, Carrie? Oh, Carrie, I'm 1,000% positive you'd be way more scared of ghosts than you're acting like. No question whatsoever. I would love to see a ghost.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact if I knew in my mind that's a ghost, it'd scare the shit out of me.
Because here's the thing. I don't think ghosts can do any harm.
I don't know, Carrie. I wouldn't risk it.
I would.
Okay. Well.
I would talk to it.
You risk it then, Carrie.
I have a history of positive feelings towards ghosts. Mm-hmm. Remember, I adopted one when I was a child.
Yeah. Okay.
From the back of my Jack and Jill magazine.
Yeah, that ghost was going to eventually kill you.
Name was Jasper.
You didn't know this, Carrie, but actually there was a ritual performed that expunged that ghost who was planning to murder you.
I don't think so.
I didn't want to tell you about this. I was told by your parents.
Uh-huh, sure.
Secretly. They told me never to tell you. I'm telling you right now on air. Okay. 2 years later, July of 1967. That's a typo. July of 1767. The servants were enjoying their nice afternoon tea in the kitchen. They heard these kind of like light footsteps coming down the service stairs. And light up, they said, okay, that must be a female. A man in his big boots would be making much louder footsteps. That's a female coming down. What's going on? It doesn't sound like Mary, their mistress. That doesn't sound like her. What's happening? And then as it came downstairs, and they still can't see anything yet because they're seeing a behind a wall, they're in the kitchen, they hear this very distinctive rustling. I guess there was a lot of gowns. The dress part was made with stiff silk. And then this very kind of loud rustling sound. And they heard that sound, and they thought, wait a second. Stiff silk is expensive. Servants don't wear stiff silk. What's going on? So all agreed, okay, something's happening here. We don't think it's Mary. They listen, increasingly perplexed as these rustling steps move closer and closer. And suddenly, right across the doorway of the kitchen, they see a tall woman in this kind of like, high-class gown. She walks quickly by them, past the kitchen door, and then out of sight. She's heading toward the front door, and they hear her steps and her rustling skirt sound as she passes seemingly through the door and then out down toward the street, toward the road in front of the house.
Wait, I have a question.
Yes.
Are there portraits of the former inhabitants of the house anywhere?
You know, I bet there are.
Like Edward and Honoria.
Yeah.
Other Mary.
We'll see. We'll see about that. Just then, a delivery man was approaching the front door from the outside. So he comes in. I mean, right then, he had to have seen her. And they immediately say, hey, who was that woman who just passed by? Did you see somebody? And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. No, no, she's wearing this stiff silk dress. She was rustling very loudly because I didn't see anybody pass by me. And I just came up from the road. Here's your meat. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's a meat delivery man or not, whatever he was. So he had not seen anyone. I don't know if they described to the locals, or maybe they did see a portrait, but the servants who had seen the tall lady very soon were assured that they had seen Honoria Stukeley.
Yeah, yeah. It would make sense that it's her.
Yeah, it would. Perhaps she's looking for her lost child, yes, just as her lover was. Regardless, Honoria was never seen again. But hey, those rustling, stiff silk skirts, I'm not going to say that again, those were heard all the time for the next 4 years until the family finally left Hinton and Appner. They never stopped hearing that skirt, but they never saw Honoria ever again.
I wonder why.
I don't know. Maybe she's leaving. But then her
No, then they wouldn't hear her.
I don't know.
Maybe she lost her ability to appear.
To manifest? Yeah. It's possible, yes. Noises continued unabated. They were loud. They were varied. They were like things like groans. There were those rustlings. There were footsteps. I think there was even, I don't know if there's chains rattling, but there's loud noises too. And they were mostly heard by the servants. And for the most part, Mary Ricketts continued to dismiss them. And often she would tease her frightened staff and just kind of make fun of them. She also literally dismissed her staff. To her logical mind, this part was important. So she ran through staff. Here's a quote from her. I mentioned these changes among my domestics, though in themselves unimportant, to evince the impossibility of a confederacy. For the course of nearly 7 years and with a succession of different persons, so that at the time of my leaving Hinton, I had not one servant that lived with me at my first going thither, nor for some times afterwards. So if it was some kind of a staff thing, her staff completely turned over during the course of their tenancy there.
Yeah. And they all still have the stories.
All the staff from day one member to day end of tenancy heard and witnessed these things.
Which they could have been telling each other. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. But that does make it, I mean, she's a smart woman. That does make it very unlikely that it was some kind of a servant put on kind of thing.
Yeah.
It just makes that be very weird. In 1769, they've been there like 4 years or so. Henry Ricketts, he had a lot of business back in Jamaica. He couldn't put it off anymore. He owned a lot of land, had some business interests back in Jamaica. And
so he's one of those.
He's one of those. Yeah, probably not a great person.
Yeah, he deserves to be haunted.
Yeah, he did. I'm sure he had slaves. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he had plantations. I don't know exactly what his business is, but he was going to be there and he's going to be gone for a long time. He had to go back in 1769, so he did. He sailed for the Caribbean, knowing he'd be gone for at least many months, if not longer. So the household he left behind was now composed of Mary, her three children, and eight staff. As if it saw an opportunity, the hauntings almost immediately escalated. And now, I know, that's weird. And now they began to be heard by Mary herself. Particularly, the first thing she started to hear was that rustling silk dress. It came to be so loud, it just disturbed her night and day. One time, she was sleeping. She slept in the yellow bedroom now. And so she's sleeping upstairs in the yellow room. When she heard the rustlings come so close, now you have the bed curtain things, right? So you can't see outside of your bed, essentially, back in the big four-poster beds, right?
Yeah.
So she couldn't see anything, but she heard the rustling. It was so loud and so seemingly close to her that she was awoken from a sound sleep by the sound of this rustling that couldn't be there.
Yeah.
Constantly, when this happened, she would get up and check the house. She'd check her room. She'd check the hallway. She'd check the house, and she never found anyone near enough. I mean, sometimes she would bolt up and pop out into the hallway and never found no one, never saw anybody, you know, running down the hall or anything like that.
Did she change her tune in her journals after this?
She probably felt bad. She probably did not apologize at all to anyone ever, because you don't, but still. She
was she saying mean things to the servants about
it? No, she just
was
laugh just
writing. Oh, okay.
Like, you know, you're just superstitious. Shut the fuck up and go make me a chicken pot pie. I don't know. Okay. She probably didn't say those things. She was smart and thorough, though, about it. So she wrote, quote, Repeatedly disturbed in the same manner, I made it my constant practice to search the room and closets within and to secure the only door that led from that room on the inside in such manner as to be certain no one could gain entrance without passing through my own apartment, which was always made fast by a draw bolt on the door. It's a very long sentence, the way of saying she was certain in her head that she could, someone couldn't have snuck in, snuck out. Back to the quote. Yet this precaution did not preclude the disturbance, which continued with little interruption. So she's hearing this, these silk skirt rustling by all the time.
Yeah.
As convincing as anything to Mary, though, was that she noticed that her cat could seemingly also hear these ghostly sounds.
Yeah.
At times, her beloved little lap cat would jump off her lap, look just terrified, probably hiss, probably ears back, I'm assuming, and it would skulk down and skitter under the sofa, and she could not coax it out. It wouldn't come out until the noises had completely abated.
Yeah.
So that was, she thought a lot of that. She thought that was, you know, that was rationally, that was intriguing because an animal seems to be reacting to these noises.
Mm-hmm.
The chilly winter of 1769-1770 brought a little bit of light to the situation, apparently, for at least for Mary. She wouldn't act on it yet, but she would think about this later. That was when an old vagrant, he was living in a nearby town called West Meon. He came to the manor, I'm assuming probably asking for food and money or something like that, I guess.
Yeah.
He told Mary of a local story that perhaps she had not heard. It was, I don't know, like, oh, give me, feed me, and I'll tell you a story. So he told her about the legend. Back in the days when Mary and Honoria's father, Sir Hugh Stukely, Mary Stukely, the original, had been alive. So the this has got to be decades ago. At that time, Sir Hugh had called in a carpenter to Hinton Ampner. That carpenter had been told and directed to construct like a hidey hole, kind of a little area in beneath the floorboards in the dining room. To the carpenter, it was obvious that it would be like a kind of safe. And apparently, he was told, you don't tell anybody about this, or I'll kill you.
Yeah.
By Sir Hugh. It was assumed then by the carpenter that Sir Hugh had secreted important papers in there, or maybe even valuables or something like that, into this little hidey hole in his dining room floorboards. Mary was fascinated by the story. She thought it was really interesting, but she kind of quickly put it aside. I guess she just, I'm not going to go dig up my you know, floorboards on the word of some, you know, vagrant passing by telling me stories, but she did think it was interesting, and she would think about it a few years later. So in the summer of 1770, about 6 months later after this, after that happened, Mary would experience perhaps the most frightening event during her stay at Hinton Ampner. Here it is in her words, quote, in the summer of 1770, one night that I was lying in the yellow bedchamber, parentheses, the same I have mentioned that the person in drab colored clothes was seen to enter. So I skipped that, but she had seen. I'm sorry. I did tell you that her nursemaid had seen that guy go into the yellow bedchamber.
Yeah.
She said, I had been in bed half an hour, thoroughly awake and without the least terror or apprehension on my spirits. I plainly heard the footsteps of a man with plodding step walking towards the foot of my bed. I thought the danger too near to ring my bell for assistance, but I sprang out of bed and an instant was in the nursery opposite. And with Hannah Streeter, a nursemaid, and a light, I returned to search for what I had heard back in her own room, but all in vain. Still quote, there was light burning in the dressing room within, as usual, and there was no door or means of escape save at the one that opened to the nursery. This alarm perplexed me more than any preceding. Being within my own room, the footsteps as distinct as ever I heard, myself perfectly awake and collected, end quote. So someone came in her room with loud footsteps. She jumped. She must have ran right by this person or just didn't see them.
Yeah.
Got the nurse. They went back and there's no means of escape. I'm not sure if it's across the hall. You know how rooms back then, they weren't super well planned out. So sometimes you had to go through rooms to get to rooms,
right,
things like that. Yeah. I don't know exactly how the floor plan looked, but in her own mind, she was convinced someone couldn't have gone by her.
Right.
No, I mean, you could think this could have been a hypnagogic dream. You know, she's starting to fall asleep or something like that, but it could have been a horrifying haunting too. So there's more noises going on. There's footsteps. It just never stops banging. You have Honoria's rustling silken traipsing about. She even started hearing music sometimes. She heard like soft music and no one was playing any music sometimes. Oh. But usually these noises were louder and even violent.
Yeah.
Quote, I once or twice heard sounds of harmony. And one night in particular, I heard three distinct and violent knocks as given with a club or something very ponderous against a door below stairs. It occurred to me that housebreakers must be forcing into some apartment, and I immediately rang my bell," end quote. So she thinks, her first thought is, oh, someone's breaking in.
Yeah.
She rings her bell. When no servant responded, though, she just forgot about it. She said, okay. Moving on. And didn't think more about it. She was just a very level-headed woman. It's like, okay, that was nothing. So she wasn't jumping to conclusions.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem like someone who wanted there to be ghosts in this house. In the winter of 1770, 1771, perhaps the oddest sound came. By this time, Mary had moved to the chintz bedroom. I believe it was named for its decor. What is chintz exactly? It's a pattern, isn't it? Or is it a material?
I'm not sure.
It was, I guess it's decorative chintz. I don't know what that means. So it's called a chintz bedroom.
When I hear chintz, I picture floral.
Okay. I guess that room is warmer. So she moved there from the yellow room and it made that her bedroom.
Yeah.
Mary wrote that at this time she was, quote, frequently sensible of a hollow murmuring that seemed to possess the whole house. It was independent of wind, being equally heard on the calmest nights, and it was a sound that I had never been accustomed to hear, end quote. So the first thing you think is the wind, something like that. She said, even on completely windless nights, they would sometimes hear this murmuring sound, this strange murmuring sound, and it would sound like it's going through the entire house. Later in the winter, it was February 27th now of 1771, the nursemaid, her name was Elizabeth Godin, she came into Mary's room that night. Mary immediately saw that, okay, something's going on here. She saw that Elizabeth was upset, so she asked her if she was ill. Here's what Mary wrote. She, Elizabeth, said she was well, but had never in her life been so terrified as during the preceding night, that she had heard the most dismal groans and fluttering round her bed most part of the night, that she had got up to search the room and look at the chimney, and though it was a bright moonlight, she could not discover anything. I did not pay much attention to her account, but it occurred to me that should anyone tell her it was the room formerly occupied by Mr. Parfait, the old housekeeper, she would be afraid to lie there again. Mr. Parfait, dying a few days before at Climston, was brought and interred in Hinton Churchyard the evening of the night this disturbance happened. So it's interesting. She's thinking, I don't know if that's a ghost, but if it was a ghost, I think I know who it was. So she thought that it might have been the ghost of Mr. Parfait, and that he had gone back to his room,
right,
having been buried in the nearby churchyard. Interesting. On April 2nd of that year, that was 16 years to the day of Lord Stawell's death.
Uh-huh.
Mary was roused from sleep by the sound of footsteps in the hall right outside her room, and it sounded to her like it was more than one person. There's two or three people out there stomping around. So, like, are they intruders? What are they? They're clomping around for, like, and she's listening to this for like 20 minutes. And then she decides, you know, enough's enough. She went into the adjoining room and she awakened the maid. I guess that room, I just didn't have to go to the hall, I think, to get to the maid. So she wakes up the maid. She brings the maid back to her room and they sit there and huddle together and they listen to the time. And yes, the maid says, yeah, I hear it too.
Uh-huh.
There's somebody walking. There's more than one person clopping around out there. And it sounded like someone was repeatedly opening and closing the door to the yellow room, which is just down the hall.
Oh.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Mary and her maid finally said, okay, screw it. We're going out there. They go out into the hall. And what do they see?
Nothing.
Nothing whatsoever, of course. But not only that, but Mary, And Mary realized that the only people on the second floor that night were her, the maid she was with, and the three children in their beds asleep.
Uh-huh.
For even better measure, the yellow room door was closed and locked. So how was it being opened and slammed closed repeatedly?
Yeah.
Later that summer, that weird hollow murmuring one night was, and it was, you know, doing its usual sound, but then suddenly it seemed to morph and it became the sound of voices, and they started hearing these voices. The voices kind of rose. They became a little more rapid. One of them seemed higher pitched, like as a woman, but they just could hear distinctly two other voices that were deeper and believed that was men. It sounded to them like a woman and two men were arguing. And at the very least, they're having some kind of a very tense discussion. And despite how these voices were pretty loud, they were incomprehensible.
Yeah.
She could never pick out words.
Yeah.
It's like, I can hear them. as if they're in the next room,
yeah.
but I can't understand what they were saying. She could never understand anything they were saying to one another, but this thing would go on for hours and hours and hours, late into the night, sometimes even into the next early morning.
Wow, that's
so
interesting.
Can you imagine you're hearing an argument between three people,
yeah.
like in the next room, and you can't understand what they're saying, and there's no one there.
Did she say if they were all male voices or male and female voices?
I just said one female and two males.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
It's good. You do a good job of nodding as if you're listening. So that's good.
No, but I am listening, but hey, do you need me to point out?
Hey, it's been said, I have asked questions that you had just said. This
exactly.
Before. Sure. It happens. It's going to happen. Once during one of these spectral arguments, Mary heard her bed curtains being rustled by someone in the room right outside. So that's
now that one
like the maid.
Me.
Remember, the maid heard the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that was scary. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I remember the maid got up. Mary gets up, so she heard someone like right there outside the bed curtains, walking around her bed, and just sort of like leaning against the bed curtains as it walked by, because they're fairly taut, aren't they? Sometimes. Are they?
I'm not sure. No, I think they just hang.
Will they just hang? Well, it's like they're rubbing against it as they walked around her bed.
Yeah, like my tent at Girl Scout camp.
Oh, yeah. That would be scary. Girl Scout camp. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Mary was sold now. She wrote, quote, "These things were beyond the power of any mortal agent to perform. But knowing how exploded such opinions are, don't know what that means, I kept them in my own bosom and hoped my resolution would enable me to support whatever might befall." So she was sold. She thought it was something supernatural.
Yeah.
But she didn't want to talk about it, it sounds like. 1 month later, Mary had enough. Her husband was still in Jamaica, of course. The months it sounds like turned into a couple of years now. So Mary had a visit from her brother. His name was John Jervis. He was already at the time a prominent naval captain. He'd be a future admiral of the fleet.
Wow.
And he'd be the main mentor to the famous Captain Horatio Nelson, the famous British naval war hero, as you know. What? Why are you chuckling? You've never heard of Horatio Nelson?
Of course
they have.
They have
a statue of him, I believe, somewhere.
Uh-huh.
It was late July 1771. The ghost, as if it was strategic, though, went quiet during the entire week-long stay of her brother John while he was visiting. Just nothing happened. He's like, what? I don't know if she had told him, but I don't think she had told him about it. I think she's like waiting for him.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to hear this stuff, and then I'm going to tell him what's going on.
Right.
Nothing happened.
Of course.
As soon as he left, literally the day after he left, the noises resumed.
Wow.
On that very night after her brother left, Mary heard what sounded, in fact, like a cannonball, something extraordinarily heavy, falling very fast from like outside her room, right? It sounds like something's falling, like a whoosh. I don't know exactly, but and then slammed and thudded into the floor with just a resounding thud, like literally something extraordinary, like a cannonball had fallen through the ceiling and landed on the floor outside her room. She cries out to Elizabeth, the nursemaid, like, "Did you hear that noise?" No answer from the nursemaid. She cries out again, "Did you hear that, Elizabeth? Did you hear that noise?" And finally, Elizabeth just sort of in this terrified near whisper says, "Yeah, I heard it. I'm just too scared to speak right now." That was not the worst of it, though. That was not the worst of it, though. Quote, "Just at that instant, we heard a shrill and dreadful shriek, seeming to proceed from under the spot where the rushing noise fell and repeated three or four times, growing fainter as it seemed to descend till it sank into the earth." So a scream, almost like following the path of this heavy object. Back to the quote, "Hannah Streeter, one of the maids, who lay in the room with my children, heard the same noises and was so appalled she lay for 2 hours almost deprived of sense and motion."
Yeah.
So three people
heard
this crazy sound of this thud and then these screams that fall that just slowly echo down into the ground below them.
Yeah.
Hannah.
I've lay in bed just terrified. Yeah.
Wait, I thought you did not have fear for anything ghostly as you've bragged about at multiple episodes.
Did I say
now.
Terrified of a ghost? No.
So what were you afraid of?
I don't
remember. So just
sounds, scary sounds, and you know, which I attribute to bad people.
Oh, so you think
coming to do harm.
And you're a child? Or is this adulthood?
It's probably happening in adulthood.
Did it happen last night? Okay. All right, Carrie.
Now I sleep with a big dog, so yes, I don't. I'm big not doggy. Scared.
Big doggy's not gonna let nothing happen.
If he doesn't wake up, then it's okay.
Yeah. If the dog goes deaf, you're dead. Hannah was kind of new to the household, so even after hearing this and after being terrified in her bed, she expressed a wish to hear more of the ghost. Even after this horrifying night, she's like, oh my God. Okay, in hindsight, now it's daytime. That was so cool. I'm going to hear more of this stuff. You guys say Seriously? This happens all the time. I can't wait. I want to hear more. Mary wrote that this was rash. And so, quote, from that night till she quitted the house, there was scarce a night passed that she did not hear the sound as if some person walked towards her door and pushed against it as though attempting to force it open. Mm-hmm. So Hannah got more than she bargained for. And it sounds like she took off. Yeah, don't tempt a ghost. Don't dare a ghost to haunt you. That's never a good call. So Mary wrote to her brother and begged him, you have to come back. Come back to Hinton after some stuff's going on. Again, I don't know if she told him what. I think she did give him an idea of what was happening. Uh-huh. He was stationed in Portsmouth, again, not that far away. So he agreed. He came back. This time he brought with him his manservant and a naval colleague to be witnesses, I guess. That they sort of stationed themselves in a room, or maybe in their own rooms, but they agreed they're going to sit up all night and they're going to try to catch this ghost in the act if they hear anything. So every night for the next week, they sat up listening for ghosts. What do you think happened?
Nothing.
Uh-uh. Oh. Every single night, the ghost brought out their full repertoire of footsteps, of voices, of banging doors. One night, they even heard a gunshot and then the sound of like a person groaning as if they had been shot, but there's no one in the room.
Are they just putting on a show? Because this stuff didn't happen in real life, right?
No, I don't know anything about a legend of a gunshot now.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ghosts had become entertainers,
perhaps.
So they'd always search the house. They'd in basement, attic, they'd search it, and they'd never find anything. So they'd hear these noises, do an instant search of the house, find nothing and no one. The next night, a neighbor named Captain Luttrell came over and he heard all the stories and said, I'll help. I'll join your vigil. And so he did. And again, so what they did this time, they pre-searched, is someone hiding here? They searched everything. Like I said, even the attic and the basements, and they went through and they locked every door that was unoccupied by staff or family. Uh-huh. Mary and Elizabeth, for them, they locked themselves into Elizabeth's room and they locked the children in all of their rooms. And they're going to, the men are going to listen for this, because right. I don't think they're in the same room. So he said, so Mary wrote that Mr. Luttrell felt something, quote, flitted past him when my brother, meaning John, directly called, look against my door, because John had heard those same footsteps and they're approaching his room. And, like there's someone out my, look at my door. There's someone outside of my room. Mr. Luttrell did not see anybody there. The men, though, they heard steps even as they got together. I think they left their rooms and they're out in I don't know whether if they're in the lobby now, but they heard footsteps but could see no one. So they did the same thing. They searched everything again. They found nothing. They huddled together until the break of dawn, thinking, okay, our ordeal is probably over, but it was not. Mary, still in Elizabeth's room, heard her own bedroom door repeatedly opened and slammed. So she's in Elizabeth's room across the hall. She's hearing her bedroom, the chintz room, being opened, slammed, open, slam, open, slam again. And of course, the men rush up and see nothing.
Nothing.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, did she talk to the owner, whoever's renting it out?
That's a good question. I don't know if they did have communication. I would think she would have. Or at least she says she didn't really want to talk about it because she felt, I think she
silly.
Felt
silly. Yeah. But at this point, you have so much corroboration.
I know.
That
and now you have, although Captain Jervis is not going to go public with this. He's a public person.
No, but some of the other people probably.
I don't know. I locals talked about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's widely known in town, but not beyond that, apparently. The next night, Captain Jervis heard that odd sound of something heavy falling like to the floor and through the floor, followed by those piercing screams that faded away. So he heard that kind of thing again. He could not explain it. It was baffling to him. He was perplexed. I imagine he was probably also a little terrified. So there's only one thing left to do, he told Mary. Get the hell out of this house. Yeah. You are leaving now. This is bullshit. You're not going to live here anymore. Jervis, he had to get back to duty. He had to go back to Portsmouth. So he basically made his sister swear, you're going to leave this house, right? And she said she promised to do so, but she needs some time to pack up. So he said, okay, I'm going to send my lieutenant of the Marines, Mr. Nichols. He's going to stay here and protect you until you pack up and leave. By the end of that week, the family was gone from Hinton Ampner, never to lay foot in that house again. The family, Mary Ricketts, offered a reward of £60 for anyone who can tell me what's happening here and explain it. Her husband soon thereafter got returned. She'd been staying with relatives. Soon thereafter returned, and he said, okay, let's make that £100.
How much?
$7 trillion in today's money, I imagine. I don't have any idea. A lot of money.
Okay.
£100?
I know.
No, that's a shit ton of money. They apparently were quite well to do. And no one ever claimed that reward. The caretaker servants who remained behind when she left, they said the sounds are still happening. It's still going on. But she didn't come back. Lady Hillsborough, now she's got the house back. She needs to rent it again. So she does. And she rented it to a tenant who lasted 6 months.
That's a long time.
Way smarter, frankly, than the Ricketts, who were there for 6 years with this shit going on. He's like, nope, I'm out.
But how much time passed once Mary started experiencing
years.
It?
Years, at it least 4 years. Yeah,
oh, wow.
At least 4 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's amazing that they stayed that long with that kind of thing going on. No one ever lived in Hinton Ampner again. And then in 1797, the Hillsboroughs decided to raise it to make room for a new manor. So the house is knocked to the ground and they're clearing all of the whatever, the stuff, the stone? We don't know. Wood, adobe, we don't know. Stucco.
Probably not adobe.
3D printing. I don't know. And what do the workmen find? But a small box buried under the floor of what they believe had been the lobby. Inside, they found...
a baby skeleton.
Bones.
No.
Yeah. Little bones. Also a skull. A small skull. Someone there said, hey, that's the skull of a monkey. Oh, but they knew. Everyone must have known. A few years later, an old woman said she had been a housekeeper during the time that Lord Stahl was still alive.
Uh-huh.
She's on her deathbed. She said, listen, I need to make a confession. I need to get something off my chest. I know something. She begged someone in her family, go to the house of the Jervises and tell them, send one of the family members of the Jervis here to my house to my deathbed, and I need to unload something that's haunted me for all these years. Sadly, before anyone from the Jervis family could get to her house, she had died, which makes you wonder, what tale do you suppose would she have told Carrie?
A death of Honoria's baby.
That's what I think. The story, as I mentioned, came out in the 1870s, over a century after the events supposedly took place. It is said to have been an inspiration for Henry James's ghost story, The Turn of the Screw. So, which one of the greatest ghost stories ever, which I believe was written in the late 1890s. So what do you think happened at Hinton Ampner in the middle of the 18th century in Hampshire in England? Any thoughts, Carrie?
No.
The obvious thing is there's a ghost. And there are all these stories. Of course, we you know the kind of shape of what that ghost story took. And people looking at it said there was this guy that the Lord Stawell had this awful person. He was his bailiff. And his name was Isaac Mackerel. And he was this dreadful person with his hoarse, guttural voice. And he, you know, did his Lord Stawell's bidding. And Lord Stawell was supposedly pretty gross and did a lot of nasty stuff.
Yeah.
And at one point, Lord Stawell found this guy, Mackerel, stealing from him, didn't fire him. And Mackerel bragged that, I've got a hold on him. I know something terrible that he did. He can't fire me. So that's supposedly, and that's supposedly something terrible is what you
right.
think it is,
yeah.
is that they had a child and they murdered that child because it would have ruined them with the scandal, would have been known that they had a baby together, he and Honoria. The other thing, there has been some natural causes. Like some people say that it was water or some kind of seismic activity. Like some, like it could have been caused by the underground water or just, you know, seismic activity in the house. That seems ridiculous. Okay. It certainly doesn't explain the apparitions themselves.
No.
I don't think it explains. I mean, maybe the murmuring, maybe water under the house. That's about it, though. Not, you know, screams and not voices and things like that. The other thing, obviously, is if it really happened or not. Is it just a story? There is this kind of contemporaneous account from a future admiral, John Jervis, that seems to add some validity that these things really did happen back in the 1760s and early 1770s. But did the family embellish it when they sold it to a magazine in 1870, 1872? I don't know. But it makes for gripping reading. Her diary is a little, you know, stilted the language, but she's very level-headed. She's talking about things very matter-of-factly.
Right.
And very, she's very clear about what she's seeing and hearing.
Although, approximately how much time do you suppose passed from when Honoria would have had this baby to when they found this box?
Oh, 50 years-ish, something like that. Bones,
baby skeletons do not last. Okay,
let me see here. 42, 90. I mean, probably something like more than 50 years.
Yeah. So I know it wasn't in dirt.
Yeah.
But it's not sealed airtight if it's in like a wooden box. Yeah. So
Do you know, is 50 plus years enough to turn baby bones into dust?
In the Paul Fronczak case, remember? Oh, yeah.
That was like 20-ish.
No, it would have been 50-ish years.
Oh, it would have been 50? Oh, yeah. Okay.
They uncovered, they found those bones. Remember when he dug in the yard and he consulted a forensic anthropologist or whatever. Mm. And she said, those aren't human bones because if they, and just so you know, a baby skeleton would have been dust by now.
Huh. Well, maybe in that mild Hampshire weather, the bones last a little longer. I choose to believe that because I think it was the ghost of Honoria and Edward Stallwell who had done something very terrible.
Yeah.
You don't believe that. Sure. It's Hollywood world, so yes, you do.
Sure. Carrie, yes, I believe.
You do.
And just one small detail being embellished does not negate the entire story.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. I think it's one of the better haunted house stories that I've come across. One of the more believable haunted house stories that I've come across. Could there be exaggeration embellishment? Of course there could.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's a corner.
But like you often talk about, it never got exaggerated to such a crazy level.
That maybe is why I found it so interesting, is that the protagonist, the narrator, seems so rational and so thought and doesn't, resisted belief in this for a very long time before she finally, had to believe what she was hearing and seeing.
And nobody was hurt. Nobody,
they were scared.
I like that the kids have almost no role.
You know what?
Whatsoever.
I thought about that. What
are
the kids doing?
They slept through it all.
Did they sleep through it all? Did they hear these things and talk about it with one another or something like that? I don't know.
Because she surely would have written.
You would think.
If her children were coming to her and telling her about this stuff.
I read most of her.
Because she would care that her children are terrified.
For sure.
I would think.
My guess is, yes, they didn't hear a lot of it.
Yeah.
But they had to have. They had to have heard some of it.
Kids can
screaming.
Yeah, are you kidding?
I suppose.
Kids can sleep through lots of
I hope they didn't hear it. Part of me kind of hopes they did.
I know.
Like I said, I would love just absolutely, I would do anything to see a ghost. Like we talk about haunted hotels and no one wants that room.
You're going
to
be so scared.
I would be scared, but I would love to see it.
Run screaming through the building.
For sure, poop myself and probably run screaming eventually. But before I ran screaming from that room, I would have seen a ghost, and that would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would absolutely, if there was a hotel and they say, here's the haunted room, I want that room.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Although these days, most of it is just
bullshit. Hey, that hotel we stayed at Denver was supposedly haunted.
Yes, it was. And I'm angry because I didn't find out until we checked in already that there was a haunted room. Although there was like a penthouse or something that we weren't getting that.
No.
So, okay. Well, anyway, that is the story of the haunting of Hinton Ampner with a little Greek history thrown in there or Roman history there as well. I hope you enjoyed.
Thanks.
All right. See ya.